info session tomorrow. Yeah. Applications due here. Email us here.
Do you want me to talk about the conferences?
Yeah, conferences and then just the.
Projector's not working. I'll be back in a minute.
Okay.
Yo, Ollie, did you give it to her? It's fine. You can just make it. Should I just start?
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. Hello? So, hi, everyone. My name is Krish, and this is Jess. And we just want to make a quick announcement today about a group on campus called GPS. So, GPS is an intercollegiate investment fund between 8 different schools, and we manage real money portfolio. We meet every Sunday, and it's an organization for people who are interested in investing. It's a lot of fun. You have conferences throughout the year, and this week and next week and the week after, we're opening up applications to take on new members to the group.
Yeah, so we'll be having an information session tomorrow during Common Hour in KMEC 350. And to apply, all you need to do is submit your resume and cover letter to nyu.recruiting@gps100.com. It's a really great opportunity that we all went through and we really appreciated. So we definitely invite you to come and apply.
Yeah, and applications are only for freshmen and sophomores. But if you know anyone who's interested, everyone should just come out and learn more about us. We focus, our strategy is focused on long-only value investing. And if you have any questions, you can see us after class, or if you see any of us in the hall, feel free to ask us. Thanks.
So I never asked this question. I should have last week. How many of you are sophomores? You have no idea what you are. How many are juniors? Okay. So it's about 50-50, is it? No, more junior, a little more juniors than sophomores. No freshmen, right? No seniors? No premature graduation problems here? Because sometimes with senioritis that happens. You get to the last year, you're pretty much done. So thank God I don't have to deal with that. So, you know, again, don't let the fact that you're a sophomore intimidate you. There's nothing here that is magical that you can't get. Okay? It'll all stick as you go along. A couple of news stories. I don't know whether you've been reading. One is, did you read about Marissa Meyer's announcement at Yahoo this morning? One thing I'd strongly suggest you start doing is read the news. If nothing else, it'll cement what we're doing in class. So Marissa Meyer finally announced today that she's laying off employees, cutting costs, shrinking Yahoo. 13 earnings quarters after she came in as CEO and was told to turn the company around and make it a growth company again, she's finally saying, can't do it. Took a while to get there. Hey, that's the first. The second is, I don't know whether you read over the news over the weekend, that Xerox is breaking up into two companies. Legendary name, right, Xerox? How legendary? For a while, you didn't say you wanted to copy something, you Xeroxed it. I actually went around this building all through the floors. I was like a creepy person checking things out. I wanted to see how many Xerox copiers I could find in this building. Not one. It's a legendary name, but it's a carcass walking around. Right? If that sounds crude, that's what it is. There's nothing left. In fact, I feel badly for Rochester. Not only do they have to deal with the winters that they do, but the two great names that came out of Rochester. One is Xerox. You know what the other one is? Eastman Kodak. Again, a company that in the 1950s was legendary. It was one of these were two stocks that were part of the Nifty 50. In the early 70s, these were the 50 highest growth companies in the world. But this too shall pass. Hey. I know how many of you are Peyton Manning fans. I'm a Peyton Manning fan. Hey, any Peyton Manning fans? Hey. I'm sorry? You want to eat or you want to watch him play, you know? Okay, so you're just doing the Peyton Manning imitation. Okay, I get it, okay. But let's face it, the reason we remember Peyton Manning is not because he had a chicken parm sandwich, but because he's a legendary quarterback. I'm a Peyton Manning fan, but I don't expect him to throw for 500 yards this Sunday. Why? He has no arm, no neck, no... I mean, basically, the guy is pretty much strung together. At 39, he's coming apart. So he's going to do, he's got a head on his shoulders still. He'll do whatever he needs to do, but it's not going to be the Peyton Manning of 4 years ago, 3 years ago, or even 5 years ago. It's not going to happen. That's basically what you want companies to recognize, right? There's a point in which you have to say, look, we used to be able to do those things. It was so great when it lasted. But that's not the company we are right now. And it's not easy. I'm not suggesting that any CEO wakes up and says, I'm going to have fun making my company smaller. But that's, I think, what you're going to wrestle with in this class, are companies that don't act their age in either direction. So let me go back to where I left you on Wednesday. Basically, I gave you the utopian world from which corporate finance is born. And in that utopian world, let me remind you what I assumed. I'm sorry about my husky voice. I've been working on getting a TV part, I guess. Actually, I've been losing my voice. So today, if I go into no voice mode at about 4 o'clock, I'll do the Vanna White thing. Slide. Now, so maybe you'll get it still. Hopefully, my voice will last until 4:45. But on Wednesday, when I described the utopian world, remember the four assumptions I made. I assumed that stockholders have complete power over managers. And managers go out and do what's right for stockholders. First assumption. Second, I assumed if you lend money to the firm and don't protect yourself, nothing bad happens to you. Third, I assumed that firms reveal information about themselves honestly and on time to markets, and the trading room in this world is full of polite intellectuals. And finally, I said there are no social costs in this world. Why did I need that? Because I wanted to make the world safe for maximizing stock prices. It's such a neat objective. The reason people like it in theory, is you can do all this stuff with maximizing stock prices, but it comes with a whole kettle of fish in terms of assumptions. So today we're going to do a reality check. We're going to take every one of these assumptions and shred them. Okay? I call this my inoculation class because I'm going to inoculate against all the things you're told is wrong with corporate finance we're going to talk about today. And I'm going to give you my spin before they put their spin. So let's go through link by link and let me lay out what the real world looks like. So this is a reality check in terms of each of those assumptions. Let's think first in terms of stockholders and managers. What did I assume? The utopian world? Stockholders have complete power over managers, and the two mechanisms they use to exercise that power are the annual meeting and the board of directors. They, in theory, they work for the stockholders. They're supposed to keep an eye on managers. In practice, neither mechanism is that effective, and I'll come back and talk about why. It's very difficult for stockholders to pull managers back into line at an annual meeting. It's even more difficult to get boards of directors to do what they're supposed to do, which is keep managers in line. So first assumption will break down. And if stockholders have little power over managers, guess what managers do? What's in their best interest. It's human nature. It's not because they're bad people. Second, if you lend money to a firm and you don't protect yourself in the real world, guess what's going to happen to you? It's not a question of whether you get ripped off. It's a question of when you get ripped off. Saying, doesn't it matter who I lend to? I don't care who you lend to. The most reputable institution in the world, if you lend to them long enough, sooner or later you're going to be exploited if you don't protect yourself. So that's the second assumption it's going to break down. Third, I assume that managers reveal information to financial markets honestly and on time. Let me give you an example of how this would play out. I've been an Apple user since 1981, and for a long time, Apple did not have a laptop. 91, they finally come out with their first laptop, very loosely called a laptop because it weighed like 15 pounds. It was hot as hell. Okay, so you needed something to cover your lap first, and then you put this on, and then you collapsed. But we're finally happy. Finally, we had a laptop of our own, but it had one small problem. It sometimes caught fire. Now, this is not normal. What happened was the battery they were using from Sony heated up and just... Now, this is not normally a feature you go looking for in a laptop, right? No spontaneous combustion on that one, not on that. Oh, this one has it. I'll take it. It'll make your next presentation incredibly memorable, but your next plane trip will be a disaster. So what would Apple do in the utopian world? They'd run out to financial markets and tell them, our laptops are hot. Technically, that's not lying. But with four kids, we know errors of omission are actually much more significant. What you don't tell me is a bigger lie than what you actually tell me. So technically, they're telling the truth. But you as an investor here, our laptops are hot. What do you think? They're selling a lot. You don't think of laptops as going in flames. So let me take that back. In the utopian world, you'd run out there and say, hey, you know what, guys? Our laptops are catching fire. We want to let you know right away so you can do the right thing. Oh, remember when the first IMAPs, Apple IMAPs came out, they had all these problems. There'd be news stories of a lady who was driving 3,255 miles to a Dunkin' Donuts because the IMAPs made her do it. To which your response is, how stupid can you be? Maybe it should just drive you into the ocean and put you there, right? But they had a problem with all kinds of things. But if in the utopian world, you'd reveal it to markets. Let's take that back. In the real world, do you think companies sometimes hold back bad news? Sure. Do they sometimes sugarcoat bad news, maybe even massage it to the point of a lie? Yep. And have you been in a trading room? Have you seen a trading room, at least in the movies? Is it full of polite intellectuals? Polite and intellectual would not be the two words that come to mind when you think of a trading room. Markets do some crazy things. And then if you think about social costs, you think about bad companies creating social costs. But the reality is all businesses create social costs. This is the world we live in. This is the world we're going to talk about today. So let's start with the first of those linkages. In the utopian world, stockholders have power over managers. How do they exercise it? Every year they get together at the annual meeting. They vote on a board of directors, and the board of directors does what it's supposed to do, which is keep an eye on managers and make sure they're doing the right thing. So let's take those two mechanisms. Let's start first with the annual meeting. Anybody here own shares in publicly traded companies? Okay, good. There are quite a few. How do you have the savings to do this after NYU tuition? I want to check out what exactly is going into your portfolio. Okay. How many of you have been to an annual meeting? I own shares in 53 companies. It was 50 until a couple of weeks ago. I just bought three more. I have never, ever been to an annual meeting, and I don't intend to be at one, ever. You say, what's wrong with you? I own 1,000 shares in Coca-Cola. What is going to an annual meeting require me to do? Get a round-trip ticket to Atlanta. It's going to cost me like $600 because that's like, for some reason, the airlines seem to think New York to Atlanta, they can charge you whatever they want. Then you got to stay in downtown Atlanta for like 2 days. This is hell on earth, if you ask me. I mean, everybody leaves the city. It's like 6 o'clock. There's nobody there. It's like zombie land. That's going to cost me another $500 for that privilege. And then other expenses. By the time I'm done, it'll be $1,250. And there goes my profit for the year. So it makes no sense for me to go to an annual meeting. And that's going to be true for a lot of individual investors. Most individual investors cannot afford to go to an annual meeting. So what do we get in the mail? It used to be the mail, now it might be even digital. What did we used to get in the mail about 6 weeks before an annual meeting that allowed us to be at the meeting in absentia? A proxy, this big fat envelope. And when it landed on my desk, it went into one of two places. If I was feeling socially conscious, it went into recycling. If not trash, recycling, trash. Opening that damn thing and reading through 40 pages of people I don't even know about didn't even cross my mind. And I'm not the only one. About 40 to 60% of proxies, depending on the company, do not get returned back to the company. So when I own 1,000 shares in Coca-Cola and I throw that proxy into the trash can, what happens to the 1,000 votes that go with those shares? Does it go into the trash can with the proxies? In most companies, you know what happens to those votes? They go to the incumbent managers. I'll give you the analogy. It's like having an election where the incumbent gets the votes of everybody who doesn't show up to vote. Imagine any U.S. politician ever getting, I think in the last presidential election, less than 50% actually showed up to vote. You didn't even have to vote for yourself. You're already elected. So you can say, I'm the re-elected president. Everybody who didn't show up voted for me. It's a system tilted in favor of incumbents. That is why it's so difficult. It's not impossible. It's so difficult to get a no vote against incumbent managers at an annual meeting. You guys familiar with Jamie Dimon? What does he do? CEO of J.P. Morgan, a kind of a Julius Caesar of J.P. Morgan, Imperial Majesty. And about 2 years ago, Jamie Dimon decides to consolidate the positions of CEO and chairman of the board. We'll come back and talk about the complete incomprehensible nature of what you're just doing. Because what's the job of the board? To oversee the top management. What have you just done? You made yourself, I can't even get my brain wrapped around it. So he did this, and of course there was a bit of a backlash and stockholders pushed back. So the annual meeting, somebody managed to actually get this as a vote. Voting against Jamie Dimon being CEO and chair. And the next day in the newspaper, the Wall Street Journal reports the results of the annual meeting vote. 65% voted in favor of Jamie Dimon and 35% against. Now, if you think like a normal person, what are you thinking? 65% agreed with Jamie. But what did I just say about the 55% who did not return their proxies? So basically, he got 10% of the vote, 35% voted against him, but he started off with 55%. You're going to win. Brian Moynihan at Bank of America, this must be some problem with CEOs of money center banks. I don't know what's wrong with them. Did exactly the same thing last year. Again at the annual meeting, no vote. He went 60 to 40. The next time you see a no vote of 30, 35, 40%, you know what it should tell you? Everybody who actually took the time to vote voted no. And you still couldn't get to 51%. So the annual meeting is not a great place for stockholders to speak up. You're saying, what about those institutional investors like Fidelity and State Street? Let me show you a graph. This is the percentage of the time that institutional investors, see this orange, ugly, or whatever color that is, the orange line. That is the percentage of the time that institutional investors vote with incumbent managers. So what do you see? 1991, 92% of the time, Fidelity and State, they don't even look at what's on the vote. What do you guys want from the incumbent manager? They vote with the incumbent manager. Why do you think this is? I mean, you think they have a big stake in making sure these companies are well-run, right? Institutional investors, if they don't like the way a company is run, how do they deal with it? Rather than stay and fight, what's their response? Sell and move on. They vote with their feet. And when they vote with incumbent managers. Now, you could have a conflict of interest story. Maybe they manage the pension funds for this company, and they don't want to piss off the incumbent managers too much. But institutional investors are not going to help you out either. So annual meeting, individual investors really don't have much say. Institutional investors vote with incumbent managers. And incumbent managers control the flow of the meeting. You know what I mean by the flow of the meeting? Try going to an annual meeting, getting up and say, I have a question I think I'd like to raise. No, raise this question for a vote. It's not going to come up. And if you're in Europe, forget about it. Annual meetings are exquisitely polite affairs. People drink wine, they drink a little cracker, eat a little cracker, say, hello, sir, lord, whatever, whatever. And by the time this is all done, there was a meeting? I thought there was a tea party. Annual meetings are not that effective at getting managers' attention. So let's try the board of directors. At least in theory, the board of directors is there for one reason and one reason alone. It was created in a publicly traded company to help you as shareholders keep an eye on managers. That's the board of directors' job. So let me lay some facts about directors on the table. And then we'll talk about whether it can do its job. The first fact about directors is they're well paid. How well paid? In a typical S&P 500 company, you're probably making $400,000 to $500,000 as a director. You do have to work like 4.5 hours a week. That's kind of a strain, I'm sure. And that's up from like 3 hours a week. In fact, for a while, the trend lines were going down to the point where I was convinced at one point in time you'd be paid for not showing up. So you get paid a lot, you don't work very much. And when you do work, you're talking to the lawyers. About what? About not getting sued. What can we do to not get sued? This has become such a defensive way of looking over managers that nobody's asking the tough questions. It used to be awful, but it's now just bad. There were points in time, you used to be director in 15, 20, 25 different companies at a point in time. All of these play out, making the board a not that effective place to essentially make your case. Now, it gets worse. In many companies in the U.S., it used to be all companies, but in many companies in the U.S. and almost all companies outside the U.S., guess who comes up with the names of the people on the board? Some companies might be a nominating committee, but even there, they check it out with this guy or this person on top. How do you get to be on the board of directors of Facebook? Mark Zuckerberg's going to be surprised by a name? I don't think so. In most companies, the CEO has an active role in picking who sits on the board. So let's play a game. You're the CEO of a company. It's your job to pick 15 people to sit on your board. And you have two choices. And I want you to honestly think about which one you're going to make. The first choice is to pick the 15 most intelligent, informed people in the world who will ask you tough questions and keep you on your toes. That's option one. The second one is to go to your local country club, walk into the bar area, find the 15 most sloshed people you can find and say, would you like to be on my board? Then ask yourself, which one's going to make your life easier? When John Mack became CEO of Morgan Stanley, the first two people invited to be on his board happened to be members of his country club. I didn't check to see whether they hung out in the bar area, what their bar tab was, but I'd be interested in finding out. Left to your own devices, again, it's human nature. You're going to pick a board that essentially goes along with what you want. So board is handpicked. In most companies, directors have token stakes in the company. You're saying, so what? A director gets paid $500,000 a year for being a director. Has $50,000 worth of stock. Is the director going to think like a stockholder or a $500,000 a year cash stream employee? Again, it's a no-brainer. You are going to think like a director. And finally, as I said, this is one of those problems of directors sitting on each other's boards. If you look at boards of directors of companies, it's amazing how often you get CEOs of other companies. I don't know how you have the time to be the CEO of one company and on the board of directors of three other companies. And once in a while, they'll sit on each other's boards. That's an interesting conflict of interest, right? So let's play a game. You're a CEO, you're on my board. I'm a CEO, I'm on your board. This week it's my meeting. You show up at the meeting. You notice this big hole in my financial statements. You get ready to point it out. When you remember what? That your meeting is next week and I'll be at your meeting. So, you know what? We'll let it slide. Just $15 billion in China, and who notices stuff like that? Okay. Incredible conflicts of interest. So I'll show you examples as we go along, but essentially you already see the pieces in place as to why boards of directors are not that effective. So let's complete the process. You make it to the board. Board meeting starts. It's a book I absolutely hated meetings, and some of you might have run into this, called Robert's Rules of Order. I don't know who this Robert guy was, but he must have been an accountant. He loved to write rules. Can't do this, you can't do this. A person with Robert's Rules of Order can essentially make sure you never speak at a meeting. It's out of order. It says here, clause 3.3. You don't even know what clause 3 is. You say, shut up. No, move on. It's extraordinarily well managed. It's stage managed. Second is, there is this part of us that wants to be a team player, right? You know, it's easier to be a team player than pushback. And there's a third issue that I want to bring up. For the last 15 years, it's true. In the U.S., we've been pushing towards more independent boards. In fact, Sarbanes-Oxley, which is the new law that governs corporate governance in the U.S., passed after some of the big corporate scandals of the 1990s, requires that your board be independent. Notice what it requires, independent. Not effective, not efficient, independent. Lehman's board of directors was an independent board in 2008. Fat lot of good that did. So this is something we've wrestled with in finance, because a lot of corporate governance has become almost checklist corporate governance. You know, a checklist is basically met that. And people wonder why it's not working. If you have independent boards, how come they're not asking tough questions of managers? Now, one of the things I'm going to kind of bring as part of the class is I don't think of behavioral finance as something separate and different that you talk about in a different class. What's behavioral finance? Does anybody want to know what falls under behavioral finance? It's actually at least two people have won Nobel Prizes for it. What is it? Yeah, but what is the basis for behavioral finance? That people, if you read, Dan Ariely, in fact, if you get a chance, watch Ariely's, does these great YouTube videos on how irrational people are. Doing things like what? That they would rather buy an item that's listed at $250 and marked off 20% than buy the same item at $2. I mean, a whole set of amazingly crazy things that people do because it's hardwired. It's behavioral finance. And one of the things I'm going to draw on in this class is, this is a reality-based class. In other words, I can't talk about things and say, hey, trust people to do the right thing. So when people do crazy things because it's hardwired, I want to talk about it. And one of the things I want to talk about that I think makes boards of directors not work is you sit in a room, even if you're an independent director. There's almost this human nature to find an authority figure in the room. This is true for almost every meeting. And once you find an authority figure, then you kind of bow to that authority figure, even though you're an independent person. So you see where I'm going next? You're now an independent director. You walk into your first meeting. You don't know much about this company. You don't know much about this business. The CEO walks in. You know that he's just another human being. But at the same time, you know he's the CEO of the company. He's been in this business 20 years. And when he says, I know what I'm doing, part of you says, he's the authority figure. So if he says this acquisition makes sense, we'll go along. So that's why I don't think the way we're approaching corporate governance is going to fix this problem. In fact, I think we need to borrow from the Catholic Church. My wife's Catholic. I go to church every Sunday. I kind of know when to. I actually have the whole routine done perfectly. But the Catholic Church in the 1400s, I mean, let's face it, an institution lasts for 2,000 years. You can learn from it. Right? So in the 1400s, the Catholic Church had a problem. You know what the problem was? People were becoming saints too easily. You know, the process by which you become a saint is somebody from some part of the world says, so-and-so is a saint, 7 miracles, And so what you have is a group of people pushing somebody for sainthood. And what the Catholic Church found was the people pushing for the sainthood did all the work, and the people, there were no people pushing against because it was, they didn't have enough of a stake. So saint after saint after saint. And I guess they must have run out of wall space for saints or whatever it is. They said, we've got to slow the process down. You know what the Catholic Church created? One of my favorite, you know, names for a person of all time. What did they create to kind of counter this? They created the devil's advocate. What's the devil's advocate's job? It's when somebody gets pushed for sainthood, he is the counter. So his job is to show that the miracle you claim is a miracle is really not a miracle. It's kind of a perverse job. But essentially his job was, whatever you're pushing, I'll push back against. The church gave him resources to essentially do the pushback. An act of genius. You see, what's this got to do with the boards of directors? What's the problem with the board of directors? You have a CEO. The CEO is the authority figure. So what I'm proposing, it'll never happen, is a contra CEO. Somebody with equivalent power on the other side with resources. So CEO gets up and says, he calls in Goldman Sachs to back up his acquisition. The contra CEO calls Morgan Stanley to show how the acquisition is an awful idea. You think that'll slow the process down? Why is that a bad thing? Why in such a hurry to do a $15 billion acquisition? What's going to happen in the next 2 weeks? It'll never happen, but I think we have to think about creating these contra powers in that room, because if we don't, the board of directors is going to get steamrolled. So the bottom line is directors don't do their job. So I'm going to, as I said, I'm going to use my companies as lab experiments to illustrate how this works out. So I'm going to take Disney, and I'm going to take you back to 1997. Sounds like a long time ago, but the reason I'm going to go back to 1997 is I am convinced that this is the worst board of directors ever created at a large company ever. It's quite a contest to win. So let me take you through why I dislike this board so much. First, let me set you back in 97. In 97, the CEO of Disney was a guy called Michael Eisner, a guy whose ego was so large that he could be in a large room by himself and feel crowded. So this is the board of directors he put together. So let me go through what I dislike about the board. First, there are 17 people on the board. You're saying, so what? I have a little experiment I'd like you to run. After class today, get together as a group of 17 and decide where to go for dinner. I will make a prediction, you will not eat tonight. Because when 17 people gather around a table, you know what happens? All 17 people talk. It's time for the meeting to end. Too big. In fact, studies show that once you get past 9 members in a board, it starts to get counterproductive. Second, 8 of the 17 members on this board are insiders. Insiders in what sense? They either work for Disney now or they used to work for Disney. Remind me again what the board's job is. It's to watch over top management. Half the board is effectively Disney managers. Strike 2. Who's the chairman of the board? Oh, Mr. Eisner. Chairman and CEO. Strike 3. If this were baseball, you just struck out. This is such a bad board. I'm going to give them a 4th strike. Let's look at some of the outsiders. Maybe they're so good that they make up for this other stuff. Let's start at the top. Rivetta F. Bowers. You're saying, who's she? She was the principal of an elementary school in Los Angeles. You're saying, this is good. Disney's a kid-oriented company. If somebody's around kids all the time, match made in heaven. She happened to be the principal of the elementary school that Michael Eisner's kids went to. I'm sure it's pure coincidence that this happened. Okay? So file that away. Let's keep going down. George Mitchell is checking for steroids on the board. If you don't follow MLB, I have no idea what I'm talking about. That's okay. Father Leo O'Donovan, president of Georgetown University. I guess it's good you have some religious influence on this heathen board. But Michael Eisner's son went to Georgetown. He sat on Georgetown's board. He was a substantial contributor to Georgetown University. He'd given lots of... I'm not saying there's any quid quo pro, but it doesn't quite pass the smell test, right? And then there's my favorite example of conflict of interest. Erwin E. Russell, attorney at law. He's saying, what do you have against lawyers? Actually, a whole bunch. But this is not the forum to talk about that. But this guy happened to be Michael Eisner's personal attorney. How the hell do you get away with this? I'm putting my lawyer on the board. He's going to be an independent third party. It's nice to have your lawyer in the room saying, don't answer that question, Mike. Take the fifth on that one, Mike. But don't tell me he's going to give you independent advice. And I'm going to circle back and come to Sidney Poitier. Great actor, right? In fact, he made the list of top 10 directors in 97. He's saying, finally, somebody on this board is doing their job. He just made the wrong list. List of directors who missed the most meetings, he was at the top of the list. He missed 75% of the meetings over the previous 3 years. So guess who's coming to dinners? Guess who's not coming to the meeting this time? This is the board that's supposed to do what? Keep an eye on Michael Eisner. This is not a board. It's a rubber stamp. When Eisner says jump, they're going to say, how high? How quickly? And during the 90s, Disney did some really crazy things. I sent that suggestion that you read this book called Disney War. It is a fun book to read about how dysfunctional the management of a large corporation can get. This is like kindergarten. It's actually worse than kindergarten. So let me give you some history. Michael Eisner came to Disney from Paramount. In 1986, Disney was in big trouble. They wanted Eisner to come over and run the company. And he really didn't want to leave Paramount. Paramount was doing much better. He said, I want to leave the company. They coaxed him out of the company. And he wanted to bring his personal assistant along with him. He said, what's the big deal? Personal assistant. Remember the days before iPhones and iPads? Your personal assistant in Hollywood kind of ran your life. They told you what your name was, what your wife's name was, etc., where you lived, etc. So think of this as a pre-iPhone device that you used to kind of keep track of who you were. She said, I can't leave without this guy. He runs my life. The guy's name was Jeffrey Katzenberg. And he didn't want to leave Paramount either. So Eisner said, if you come over to Disney, I'll make you the head of a division. Yeah, Katzenberg said, PA, head of division. Okay, I'll take the head of the division. And Eisner, being Eisner, made him the head of a division that he thought was destined for doom. At that time, the animated movie division in Disney hadn't produced a hit in 15 years. The Fox and the Hound with the 70s was the last one. So Eisner thought, he can't do much with this. You can be the head of the division. And to show you how little confidence he had in this division, he said, I'll give you 5% of all the profits you make on the movies you make as head of the division. The rest, as they say, is cultural history. Because what did Katzenberg do after he came into Disney? Produced Little Mermaid, The Lion King. Can you imagine getting 5% of the profits on The Little Mermaid in perpetuity? Ariel and the Sea Witch will keep you rich for the rest of your life, right? Between 86 and 92, Katzenberg is incredibly successful in the movie division. He turns it around. By 92, it's accounting for a third of all of the profits that Disney is making. Now, remember, if this were a business class, you bring in a person who turns a division around, makes it a star division, what's supposed to happen to him? He's supposed to be on a promotion, moved up the ranks. That thought never even crossed Eisner's mind. He said, we've got to get rid of this guy. You know why, right? Threat to the throne. Basically, he said, this guy's getting so successful that he might replace me. So he goes to the board and says, I want to fire. You be the board. I want to fire the most successful divisional head I have in the company. What's the question you're going to ask me? Why? But this is Eisner's board. He said, when? How quickly? Like right away, you know? So he said, okay. And then one of you brings up this unpleasant fact that I promised this guy 5% of the profits on The Little Mermaid and Lion King in perpetuity. So what do we do about that? He said, don't pay him. On what basis? I don't like him. It's not a good legal basis for refusing to carry out a contract. But you're the board being what you are. Of course, Mike, if you say so, you fire the guy. And of course he sues. Case didn't last very long. The judge said, Mr. Eisner, did you make this promise to pay 5% of the profits? He said, yes. Why are you refusing to pay him? I don't like him. Yeah. So Katzenberg won $150 million as a settlement, which he used as seed money to do what? He started another company with it. You're all familiar with this company. No, Pixar's the wrong guy. He started DreamWorks. Now do you see? Have you watched these Shrek movies? Notice how they get these little digs into Disney. In the Shrek movie, Sleeping Beauty has an addiction problem. So she sleeps all the time. Snow White hangs out with 7 perverts in a cottage. You go through, what's going on here? What's going on here is there's a long history between Katzenberg and Disney, and every time he gets a chance, another sword in there. There's a history behind everything, right? Now, when that happened, I remember reading the journal article saying, how could the board go along with something like this? If they'd only taken a look at the board, they could have seen why it happened. In fact, sometimes all you need to do to understand why a company is the way it is look at who sits on the board of directors. I'm going to take a little tangent here. Have you heard of this company called Theranos? I'm going to tell you a story, and you tell me whether this is a great story. So what happens is a 20-year-old, first, she gets this 20-year-old drops out of Stanford, the most selective university, so already the story is getting some heft. Let's make her a female. That's even because men drop out of, they create their geeks usually. So you have a 20-year-old dropping out of Stanford, creates her own business, not a technology business, but a business that disrupts something we all hate to do, which is give blood. You've gone through that experience, right? First you make an appointment, then you show up, they make you wait an hour, then they pull out like 3 bucketfuls of blood. And then you wait 3 weeks for the results, and they tell and send it only to your... This is a very primitive system. So she said, so basically she started this company called Theranos where you could just give a few drops of blood and the test would be available, the results would be available instantaneously at a fraction of... Sounds good, right? So the company was founded maybe 5 years ago. It became a unicorn. You know what a unicorn is? But basically, unicorn is really a tech company with a value that's greater than a billion. It got to a value of $9 billion. Until last September, when the Wall Street Journal asked a very simple question, which is, does the blood test work? It's kind of a fundamental question. And it discovered the blood test didn't work. That people are attaching a $9 billion value to a company with a test that wasn't working. You're saying, how can that be? You got Ted Draper, one of the lead VCs on being an investor. You got all these people. How did... So I was curious. I did this. I call this the runaway story because the story is so good you want it to succeed, right? As I was writing the story, I felt like I was killing Bambi. I mean, but in a sense, everybody wanted Elizabeth Holmes to succeed. She seemed like a nice person, 31-year-old, changing a business. So I decided to take a look at the board of directors she'd put together. I'm going to show you a board, and you tell me whether you see a potential problem. This is the board of directors for Theranos. First, look at the last column. There's one 31-year-old, who's Elizabeth Holmes. My first reaction when I read this board was, read the names, was, he's still alive? Really? Like George Shultz. This is like a history lesson, right? 1980, Secretary of State, 94-year-old. I know there are some 94-year-olds who are really sharp and come on, though. You put a 94-year-old at a table, you go through a 2-hour meeting. I don't know what happens to that 94-year-old. But when I looked at this board, my gut feeling, maybe I'm a cynic, is if you were putting together a board that had absolutely no idea what you were doing and had no interest in asking, this would be it, right? I mean, look, in fact, if I were a little more conspiratorial, I think it was a CIA front company. Hey, look at that, defense contract. I mean, what is this? A blood test for whom? Just Russian invade? I mean, what is this for? Maybe I'm just a cynic, but you look at that board and you have to ask, what are you trying to hide? You're creating a blood test. You really want to disrupt the business. What do you expect to see on that list? Scientists? Because this has to work. This isn't an app. So my suggestion is when you pick your... How many of you have picked your company already? just act like you have. Just put your hand up. You know, if I ask you what company, you can just come up with any company you want. I mean, I don't have no idea. But pick your company soon. The first thing I want you to do when you pick your company is don't go to the financial statements. Actually, go, because I want to make sure you're not a money-losing company. Check that out first. And then return to the annual report and look at the board of directors. See, what am I going to do? I'm going to see a bunch of names. I'll give you a couple of links in checking out those names. And after you've checked out those names, you've already got the foundations for thinking about who's running this company? Where does the power lie? So that's going to be your first test, is once you get your company. So as we go through, I'll be listing off things. But let me stay with the Disney board. It wasn't just me that looked at that board and said, this isn't going to work. Have you heard of CalPERS? It's a California public employee pension fund. It is the largest state pension fund in the country. It controls $250 billion. $250 billion. The Texas Teacher Fund is the second largest, but this is the largest fund in the country. So they control a lot of money. And for a long time, they used to be very active in corporate governance. In fact, you've got to give them credit. They were one of the first institutional investors. And like Fidelity and State Street that ran away, CalPERS said, we can't afford to run away. We have too much money at play. Where are we going to run? So starting in the 90s, they started putting together a list of the 10 worst companies in terms of corporate governance in the country. And you did not want to be on the list, because once you got on that list, they started putting pressure on you to change. And a few of the questions they would ask to decide whether a company had a good board is they'd ask, are the majority of the directors outside directors? Very simple. Is the chairman of the board independent of the company? Obviously not, if you're the CEO. And third, every board has a compensation committee. They're supposed to decide how much the CEO gets paid, and an audit committee that gets to look over the accounting. Are they composed entirely of outsiders? Do you see why this in particular has to be outsiders? Because the compensation committee can decide to give away the company to the CEO if you can't watch them. Disney was the only company in 97 that failed all three tests. Since I'm piling on in Disney, let me keep piling on. Business Week in 97 decided to rank the 500 largest companies in the US from worst board to best board. So guess which list this is. This is a list of the worst board. Guess who's on top? Disney. Disney's winning all kinds of contests it shouldn't even be trying to win. So in 97, Disney's corporate governance stunk. And it stunk because the CEO had gone about creating a board that was a rubber stamp board. It doesn't happen accidentally. It was by design. So as you think about this, here's what I'd like you to look at when you start on your company. Look at who the directors in the company are. Look at outside directors, inside directors. And for most U.S. companies, there's an SEC filing that I will send you. You know what the SEC is, right? Basically, it's a regulatory commission that you file these things with. And actually, U.S. companies are required to file. There's a filing called 14DEF that every U.S. company has to file, which lists out conflicts of interest that you might have as directors. You know what? Companies are amazingly honest about that 14DEF. You know why? Because nobody seems to read it. They actually say, oh, we're conflicts of interest all over. My brother-in-law is a director. My mother-in-law is a director. My sister-in-law is a director. They all get paid on the side. And people say, people find out 3 years later, really, really, really? It was all in the 14DEF? So if you have a U.S. company, this is going to be easy. If you have a non-U.S. company, you might have a tougher time. You think, this is awful. I should have stuck with a U.S. company. Since you haven't picked a company and you're going to be inclined to make this a part of judgment, let me tell you a story from Sherlock Holmes. Okay? It's one of the stories, I think the Hound of the Baskervilles or something. Okay? So you know how the Holmes stories work. There's a murder, and it's a completely unsolvable murder. And through this entire book, Holmes treats his sidekick, Watson, like a piece of dirt. Everything. That's obvious, Watson. I don't know why the guy even hangs around. I prefer the Watson on the BBC New Sherlock show. Much better guy. But this is the original Sherlock Holmes. So in this particular book, what happens is there's a murder, and people can't figure out who did it. And then at the end, Sherlock solves the whole case. And the key clue was the dog did not bark. See, what the heck? What kind of clue is that? Well, if the dog did not bark, obviously he knew the murder. Maybe they hung out together, went to bars together, whatever it was, they were good friends. So he said, if the dog did not bark, it was somebody that was part of the household, and that cracked the whole case open. The key clue is that there was no bark. You're saying, what's this got to do with financial filings? You got a board of directors, you try to find out more about the board, and the more you try, the less you can find. What is the fact that you cannot find out any information about the board of directors in your company tell you about how much power stockholders have in this company? That to me is conclusive proof. If you cannot find information about who's on the board and what the potential conflicts of interest are, that is much stronger proof than anything you find in a 14-deck. So if you pick an Asian company, you find 11 people on the board, you've never heard of any of their names, nobody seems to have, or you're doing Alibaba, and you see those 19 names that Jack Ma's come up with. So where did he come up with the 19 names? You call Jack and say, can you tell me some information about these 19 names? And he hangs up on you. That's conclusive proof. You have no power in this company. For many of your companies, you will get a measure of corporate governance. So I'll tell you some places you can go. It's a score. Don't read too much, but basically companies are scored on this because there are services that measure corporate governance. But to me, this is the key. If you have an effective board, not just an independent board, once in a while, what should happen? They should disagree with the CEO and stop the CEO from doing something, right? That to me is what I would look for in a board. If you can show me 3 news stories of things the CEO wanted to do that the board did not let him or her do, that is good evidence to me that the board actually works. But be prepared for disappointment. 90% of your companies, guess what you're going to find? The board of directors doesn't work for you as a stockholder, it works for the management. They view their job as protecting management from you, not the other way around. So now let's go to the next step. If you don't have much power, go ahead.
Stockholders should elect the board directly.
You do. You do elect the board directly. But what's the problem with that? 60% of proxies. Who votes the proxies? What rule do you want to change? Okay, so we could start in that. Say if you throw it in the trash can, the votes don't count. We could. But then we got to get the rule changed where? This is like, have you read Catch 22? To change the rule, we got to bring it up to the meeting. And at the meeting, what do we have to do? We have to get 51% to vote in favor of the rule. We'll talk about pushback at U.S. companies. At least in U.S. companies, there is a chance of a pushback. But you need somebody powerful leading the charge. It can't be you and I. Why? Because you're only 1,000 shares. You know who we need to make life difficult for managers? Who caused Xerox to break up? Carl Icahn. Is Carl Icahn a nice guy? Don't think too long. You don't want to have dinner with Carl Icahn. He might eat you. But Carl Icahn is going to be the kind of person who can push for change, not because he cares about you and I, but because in the process of pushing for change for him, maybe he can get managers to do something that's right for us. So we're going to come back and talk about activist investing and how that can change. But I think, in a sense, if you let this process go through, incumbent managers are going to dominate the game. So now let's talk about what happens if you as a manager don't feel threatened by shareholders. There will be times when you have to make decisions. We have to ask, should I do what's right for shareholders or should I do what's right for me? I'll give you an example. Let's assume you're a top manager at an oil company. An oil company that's done badly, has a lot of cash, and you're targeted in a hostile acquisition by somebody. So what's the essence of a hostile acquisition? Somebody's paying 20% more than the market price, right? So if you view your job as delivering the highest value to your shareholders, and if there are no other bidders around, what's the thing you should be doing to, if you were doing your fiduciary responsibility, you should be selling the company to the hostile acquirer. And what's the essence of the word hostile? What is this guy going to do to you after he takes you over? He's going to fire you. So now I've made the decision stark for you. Do you want to do what corporate finance textbooks tell you to do and maximize shareholder wealth, or do you want to keep your job? Come on. Be honest with me. If you had to pick, which one would you pick? I say, I'm going to preserve my job. So that's when you're going to see managers take actions and look at it and say, what the heck are they doing? But if you step back, you'll see exactly what they're doing. First, they'll try green mail. You know what green mail is? It's just like blackmail, just a lot more money and it's legal. So here's how it works. Carl Icahn buys 10% of my company for $100 million. You want him to go away. So you offer him $250 million. So just go away. But just like blackmail, you've got to be careful because he could take the $250 million, come back again the next day. So in most green mail, you sign what's called a standstill agreement where you agree not to buy shares in the company for the next 5 years. You're saying, what's wrong with that? You're just protecting yourself. My question is, where did you come up with that extra $150 million to pay the green mail? You didn't sell your house and your securities. What did you do? You took shareholders' money and made sure that somebody didn't pay 20% more for the stock price. My mind doesn't even get around that concept, but there's only one group served in green mail, and that is incumbent managers. That's example one. Second is golden parachutes. I have to tell you, M&A is this weird mix of medieval times and James Bond movies. Like people show up on white nights with poison pills. Okay? So I don't know what it is about M&A that creates it, but golden parachute, basically, you go in, as a manager, you go into your contracts and you add a clause that says, if we're taken over, I'll get paid $15 million, $20 million, $25 million. Whose interests are served? The manager's interests are served. Because the acquirer now has to pay less to buy your company because they've got to set the money aside. Let's talk about poison pills. I'll give you the example of a poison pill, and your mind might have a little difficulty wrapping yourself around this concept, but try anyway. You know how a rights issue works at a publicly traded company? So let's say you're all shareholders in my company, and I want to raise money to take a project. Stock is trading at $10. In a rights issue, I give each of you the right to buy an additional share in the company for $5. And every one of you should exercise that right, because if you don't, you're going to end up worse off. So the rights issue is actually a fairly low-cost way of raising equity to fund a business. So that's a typical rights issue. The rights price is less than the stock price. I'm going to change that a little bit. I'm going to do a flip over rights issue, saying, what is that? Stock's at $10. I give each of you the right to buy an additional share at $100. You're saying, why would I want that right, as long as I run the company? If somebody does a hostile acquisition of the company, that 100 becomes a dollar. You see what I've created? I've created something that is going to be completely harmless as long as I run the company, but if somebody takes over the company, it blows up in their face. It's a poison pill. Now, as you wrestle with that, I'll give you a much simpler analogy that my daughter offered me when she was 8 years old. She's a financial genius in many ways. Not really, but no, I have to act like that. Otherwise, if she watches this video, I'll be in big trouble. Okay. So this was when she was 8 years old. I decided to take her and I decided to take her and the two older brothers out for breakfast. So we go to this diner, high-class outfit. And we get a table. All three of them sit on the other side. I sit by myself. Nobody wants to sit with Dad. Okay. She's in the middle, her two older brothers on either side of her. They all order eggs with fries. So the waitress comes and puts plates in front of them. Eggs with fries, eggs with fries, eggs with fries. The minute the plate gets it in front of my daughter, she spits all over her friend. Disgusting, right? But if you have siblings and you've ever eaten fries, you know exactly what she was doing. Because you're a six-year-old, two older brothers on either side of you. There are fries on your plate. You know exactly where they're going. They're not going. So you know what she was doing? She was introducing a poison pill. Why was it a poison pill? You spit on your fries. You're okay with your own spit. Everybody, you're touching that. No, that's disgusting. So the next time you hear a story about a poison pill, think about spitting on your fries, and you've pretty much got the whole thing nailed. Okay. Shark repellents. These are anti-takeover clauses that you put into your corporate charter. Let me give you an example. What percentage of a company do you normally need to control to take over a company? 51%? NCR, when it was being targeted by AT&T, raised that threshold to 80%. What does this do? It either prevents takeovers from happening, Or to do the takeover, you got to pay a much bigger premium. AT&T was stupid enough to pay the much bigger premium, but those are shock repellents. There are a whole set of anti-takeover clauses you can put in to prevent people from taking over. Again, the primary group protected by this are not shareholders. Though you can tell nice stories about shareholders, it's really about incumbent managers. And finally, there is this one action you can take as a manager. If your objective is to decisively and quickly make your shareholders poorer, this is not a great objective, but that's your objective, just go do an acquisition. It's almost laughable when you see the game playing around an acquisition. And I'll take an example to illustrate this. Yeah, go ahead. Everything ultimately gets litigated in Delaware, right? So the courts say you can do this. So the reality is, why do you think 357 companies out of the S&P 500 have their headquarters in Delaware? It's not because the Delaware courts don't agree with you. It's because they agree with you most of the time. So that's true. But at the same time, you'll go wherever the ruling. So if you don't like Delaware, you'll go to Rhode Island. It's a really small state, so you might have to stack yourself on top of each other. But you go wherever the state laws go along with you. Right? So it's not just that the Delaware courts happen to give the ruling because they wanted to keep the companies in Delaware. So that's part of the game as well. So when you think about an acquisition, think about what happens. You have an acquiring company, you have a target company. If an acquiring company overpays on an acquisition, guess who's paying for the acquisition, for that overpayment? The shareholders of the acquiring company. So let's play a game. Let's suppose you read the story of an acquisition. Every day there's some big story going, right? You could ask the managers of the acquiring company whether the deal makes sense. What's the answer you're going to get? Of course, synergy, strategic considerations. You could ask the bankers of the acquiring company whether the deal makes sense. What's the answer you're going to get? Of course. Why? Because you make fees of the deal. But there's one other group that passes judgment on whether the acquisition makes sense. And you know what that group is? The minute you announce an acquisition, the market gets to react, right? You know that in 55% of all acquisitions, the acquiring company's stock price drops on the announcement of the acquisition. So what's the market saying? You're paying too much. And if you show this to managers, and I have, you know what their answer is? They don't know as much as we do. And that's true. They don't know as much as we do. But here's the final fact to consider. You go 10 years after the acquisition. You know what percentage of acquisitions fail? 60% of all acquisitions get reversed within 10 years of the original acquisition. So after the fact, it looks like the shareholders are actually more likely to be right than the managers. In fact, the best predictor of whether an acquisition actually ends up succeeding is what happens to the stock price on the date the acquisition is announced. So try this out. The next time you see an acquisition announcement, check the stock price out of the acquirer. At least you're getting that snapshot of what stockholders think about the acquisition. So let me give you an example. I talked about Eastman Kodak, that other legendary company from Rochester. And in the 1980s, Eastman Kodak decided to do an acquisition. So basically, they targeted a company called Sterling Drugs. Now, they claimed synergy. Now, step back and think about this. What is Eastman Kodak's business? Cameras. Sterling Drugs is a pharmaceutical company. And I remember reading the story saying, exactly where is the synergy? And you've come up with a way of delivering drugs through cameras? I don't know what it is, but they did throw the word out. My guess is that it had nothing to do with synergy, but that some overwrought consultant had led them down the wrong path. Have you seen these BCG matrices that they have? They have cash cows and dogs and pigs and all kinds of farmyard animals wandering around. And as a company, you're supposed to get those stars. You know the businesses that are stars? They have big profits. You can see almost the lead into this acquisition. In the 1980s, pharmaceutical companies were the stars in the business world. They had huge margins, lots of profits. So somebody probably told Eastman Kodak's managers, you know what, your camera business is shrinking, you should buy a star. BCG, somebody made a lot of money on this advice. So Eastman Kodak went out and bought, they actually didn't buy it right away, they got into a bidding war with Hoffmann La Roche, which was a Swiss pharmaceutical company, for Sterling Drugs. stock price for Sterling Drugs before the bidding war started was about 40. So the bidding war starts, it goes 45, 50, 55. At $72 a share, Hoffman LaRoche drops out of the bidding war. Eastman Kodak did not seem to notice. It's like being on eBay. The other guys dropped out. You keep bidding yourself. I beat myself. Eventually, at $89.50, Eastman Kodak wins the bidding war. Keyword is wins, right? So the next day you open up the Wall Street Journal. What does it say? Eastman Kodak wins bidding war. Now remember, your Eastman Kodak stock orders, that's what happened to your stock price on the day you won the bidding war. You lost almost $2.2 billion in value in one day. I am convinced that Eastman Kodak's descent into hell, because it descended into hell as a corporation, started on this day. Because in one day they wiped out 20 years of hard work. Because if you're an Eastman Kodak working and did a $50 million project, you know what they'd have made you do? Jump through 50 hoops. Show me the NPE, show me the IRR, show me the return, show me the make gain. Maybe three more times. But you have to do a $5 billion deal? Nothing of the rules apply. In fact, this might be pure coincidence, but the premium that Eastman Kodak paid for Sterling Drugs was roughly $2.1 billion. So we lost collectively $2.2 billion. That's almost equal to the premium that they paid, right? You're saying, where's the extra $100 million going? Well, bankers have to be paid from something, right? So this deal happens. And of course, what do Eastman Kodak's managers say? You don't understand us. We have all these plans. Now, this is what Sterling Drugs looked like after Eastman Kodak built it. Now, remember, what's the essence of synergy? That by combining the companies, you're going to be growing revenues faster, your profits are going up. Where's the proof? Remember the Clara Pellew ad for Burger King? You probably haven't seen it. Where's the beef? Where's the beef? Where's the synergy? The revenues are growing up, but the profits are staying flat.
When you said that, the bankers will say to the company, you don't understand what we're doing here. Isn't it the banker's job to make it easily understood?
Let me ask you a question. You walk into an electronics store. You ask the salesman, what's the right TV for me? What are you going to walk home with? The 70-inch flat plasma TV. Why? Because that's what he makes a big... The fact that you live in a tiny studio, that you can't even get the TV up the stairs, is not his problem. So you call him and say, why do you sell him this TV? He says, just hang it outside the window, cover it with tarp, and just watch it through the window. It's not the banker's job. The banker's job is to do what? Make money from deals. Whose job is it to watch out for stockholders' interests? Managers. You can see, we can take it out on bankers because that's the easy thing for CEOs to say. Oh, the banker told me to do this. What do? Put a gun to your head, say you got to pay $50 billion for this company? You did it yourself. There is no excuse, but managers all too often fall back on that excuse. So you look at the 5 years after, you say, where's the synergy? 5 years later, a rumored story appears in the New York Times. And this is what it says. That there are rumors that Sterling Drugs might be up for sale. And what's the first response, Eastman Kodak? They have no plans to sell Kodak's Sterling Drug unit. And in fact, Louis Mathis, chairman of Sterling Winthrop, dismissed the rumors as massive speculation. I'm just reading it as is because I can't keep a straight face as I say these things, which flies in the face of the stated intent of Kodak that it is committed to be in the health business. This is like the old things that used to come out of the Soviet government. Never believe anything until it's officially denied. Okay. A few months later, here's what happens. Sterling Drugs is, in fact, being sold. And collectively, it was sold off for about $4.5 billion. So how much did they pay? $5.2 billion 5 years prior. They pumped in almost $3 billion into the company, and they walk away with $4.5 billion. That's a bad investment, right? You're saying people probably learn from this. They never do something this stupid again. Okay, let's move forward about 20 years. Another company in motion, Hewlett-Packard. It goes out and buys a British technology company called Autonomy. for $11 billion. Stock was trading at about 5.5, so it paid 100% premium. Of course, you have to justify it, right? So what I've done in this page is broken down how they justified paying $11.1 billion. First thing they did was they started with the pre-deal book equity, which was about $2.1 billion. They paid KPMG, I think, to come in, I don't know, with Deloitte maybe, I don't want to insult the wrong accounting firm, and to come in and reassess the assets. So after they were done, they said, it's really not $2 billion, it's $4.6 billion. The market is already trading at $5.9 billion, so why are they doing this window dressing below the $5.9 billion, I don't know. And then on top of that, they said there's a premium, and the premium is all for synergy. Okay, sounds good, right? The deal gets done in 2010. 2 years later, HP says, we made a mistake. It's really worth only about $2.3 billion. Now, how you get back from 11 to $2.3 billion is a bit of a problem. So here's how they justified the step down of the value. They said, you know what? No, they said they blame the entire thing on accounting irregularities at Autonomy. So I did a blog post then where I said, you know what? I'm going to assign blame. I'm going to find whoever's responsible and charge it to them, hoping to get the money back. No chance of that happening. So for the first part of the premium, I blamed the old CEO of HP because he pushed for the deal. And as a secondary culprit, I blamed the bankers who essentially helped him on. So let's put $4.45 billion in his account and try to collect it from him. The accounting improprieties, it's true. There was some accounting game playing. Collectively, that was about $2.45 billion. Let's blame Deloitte, who was the accounting firm for Autonomy for that, and try to get the money back from them. But after the company was acquired, they managed to run down the earnings and revenues of the company. So that has to go to Meg Whitman, who's the new CEO, and another $1.9 billion. So basically, I can take the 8-point-something billion, which they wrote off, and say, it's your fault, it's your fault, it's your fault, it's your fault. You say, why are you finding fault right now? Because I want to fire all these people. But here's the bad news. How much of these people actually returned to the coffers because they made such a bad mistake? Not $1. And that is part of the problem in acquisitions. Is a bad deal is an orphan. Nobody's, oh, not mine, not mine, not mine. And as long as that continues, we are going to get a lot of bad deals get through because nobody's watching the store. So today I'm going to send you there's a Bloomberg terminal. Is there a Bloomberg terminal you guys can access? You know what a Bloomberg terminal looks like, right? I'll take a picture if you want and send it to you, right? So it's not online. You've got to get to this terminal. I want you to find a terminal after you pick your company. And in about 10 minutes, I'm going to suggest four things I'd like you to print off for your company. That's all you need. You don't need to go back there again. This is one of the pages I want you to think about printing off. It's a page called an HDS page. And I'm at least going to start with Disney and show you what this page is useful for. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the top 17 stockholders in my company. That's what the HDS page will tell you. And then I'm going to ask, in this company, where does the power lie? You know the old saying, power abhors a vacuum? That's true in companies as well. The power goes somewhere. And let me give you some of the choices. Maybe it's one of these very unusual companies where you and I as outside stockholders actually get to run the company. You see why it's unusual? All the stars have to align, the board has to work for you, the managers have to care about you. Maybe it's one of those companies. It could be a company where inside stockholders run the company. What am I talking about? In the case of Facebook, who's the inside stockholder? Mark Zuckerberg. In the case of Google, it's Larry Page and Sergey Brin. Inside stockholders run the company. They're shareholders, but let's face it. It's not just that they own more shares. They've kind of fixed the system that even if they didn't own more shares, they control the company. So maybe it's a company where inside shareholders control the company. Maybe it's a company where managers essentially view this as their fiefdom. Company's money, that term drives me crazy. Companies don't have money. They hold shareholders' money, but these are when managers run the company, it's company's money. So when you want a dividend as a stockholder, say, get down on your knees, beg. Oh yeah, you can have a dollar. They treat you like a beggar. Got a dollar, go away. It's called the mosquito strategy for dealing with stockholders. Treat them like mosquitoes. Swat, 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 get out. No. It could be that your company, the government, doesn't own the company, but they actually have enough power to run the company. I'm going to show this with Vale as to how this works. It could be a company or employees. There are many European companies, employees actually have members on the board. They get to have a say. Or it could be a company where bankers have taken over the company. Why? Because they've gotten too terrified of what you could do to them. They've stepped in. So I'm going to take you through my Disney HDS page. And when you get a chance and you've picked a company, try to print off this page because it's a starting point for understanding where power lies in the company. So this is, I'm sorry, I skipped the page. So this is Disney, top 17 stockholders, basically based on the number of shares. First thing to notice is the source listing for this company. You're saying, what's a 13F? That's actually a filing made by a U.S. company or U.S. institutional investor with the SEC. For U.S. companies, this is where Bloomberg goes to collect the data. And what do you see on this page? 16 of the top 17 investors in Disney are institutional investors. So I want you to think like a stockholder in Disney. Looking at this page, do you feel more empowered or less empowered? Why? What do we say about these institutional investors? They vote with the managers. They don't push back. They vote with their feet. And he's saying, these guys are not going to watch out for me. In fact, there's only one person on this entire list, and it's Roy Disney. And he happened in 2003, he happened to work for Disney. We'll talk about what happened afterwards. There's a story that comes out of this. But in 2003, when I looked at this list, my reaction was, I'm screwed. As a stockholder, I have no power over this company. This is a company that's going to be run by the managers, for the managers, of the managers. Let's move to a second company. This is Vale. Remember I described it as a Brazilian company? Let me flesh out the details. Vale has two classes of shares. Every Brazilian company pretty much has two classes of shares. In Orwellian version, they're called common and preferred shares. And you're going to see why I use the word Orwellian. One of these shares has voting rights and one doesn't. Which one do you think doesn't have the voting rights, the common or the preferred? You're the preferred shareholder. Why? Because you don't have any voting rights. While you're wrestling with that notion, which makes no sense at all. I'll move on. Your voting shares and non-voting shares. Let's play the cynics game. You decide to buy Vale shares. You call your broker and you can actually buy ADRs on Vale. Which class do you think you're going to get a piece of when you buy shares? You wish you got the common. You're going to get shares in the non-voting shares. Who holds the voting shares? 8 entities. One of whom is this outfit called BNDES, which is the Brazilian National Investment Fund, controlled by the Brazilian government. And it gets worse. The Brazilian government also has what's called a golden share. You know what a golden share is? If you have a golden share, you have veto power. So if you have to make big decisions as a company, an acquisition, an investment, the government can say no. So when I look at this page, in spite of all the kind of mini details, as a shareholder of the company, here's my reaction. I have zero power in running the company. And in fact, it gets even more terrifying here. It's not just managers who will control what happens to the company. It's what the government wants. You think, so what? Well, if you think about what governments want, and then you think about how that will play out for you as a stockholder, you should be terrified. Okay? And I'll do one final thing, and then we'll end. These are the top 17 stockholders in Tata Motors. 7 of the top 17 stockholders are other Tata companies. How does that happen? This is part of a family group. Until about 30 years ago, they're all private business that invested in each other. In fact, all the Tata companies share one headquarters building in Mumbai called Mumbai House. On the second floor, there's Tata Steel, Tata Chemicals, Tata Motors. And on the very top floors used to sit Ratan Tata, the family patriarch, who actually was not a manager in any of the companies. But guess what? If he wanted something, do you think it would percolate down the elevator shafts to all the other companies? So that's what I wanted to keep in mind. When you look at Tata Motors, you're going to see other companies come into play. And what's good for the group will drive what's good for the company. So keep working on picking a company. The sooner the better. Which one are you planning to
do? I'm planning Disney. Don't you Disney?
Partly because you're going to get constantly have to second guess yourself. Because if I talk about Disney, it might get in the way of your own analysis. So pick something else. Yeah?
But it has it's a privately owned business, so there's one CEO, who's my dad, and it has the general financial statements. And
why don't you do this? Pick your family business and pick a competitor who's public in India?
In the same industry.
Same industry? It'll give you a sense at least of comparison, no? And you can make your primary analysis your company, but you can then use that peer group company as a kind of perspective on some of the other things you're doing.
So, what if I take, my dad distributes things.
Uh-huh.
So, what if I take the supplier's company? So, the one who's manufacturing the
material. Absolutely, that should work.
So, what will be my primary analysis? That company? Or
you can get to pick. So, whichever one you want to end up putting in. So, you might decide that your private business is something that you're too close to do the full analysis on. You might do the primary analysis in your supplier company and a secondary analysis in your company.
And how exactly does a primary secondary work?
You don't have to show both, right? So, in the report, you can pick one to write about, and
so
the other one you can track along.
The main company with the data is my primary
and then category. Hi, how are you?
I met you before last semester.
Yes, yes, that's right. Yeah.
During the office hour about my position in one of the startups.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's been like more than 4 or 5 months. And,
so how's it going?
A lot happened. Well, so right now my situation is a bit interesting, weird. Because for the biotech startup, I'm in the position of the chief marketing officer,
right.
Owning 5 to 7% of the company, and also.